Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Nature Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This May 5th, 2015 edition of Nature Bats Last is live. Let's hear from the studio audience.
Okay, it's not much of a studio audience. This is what being on a small amount of money gets you. You can't afford to bring many people in.
Yeah, and you do the show on a phone. So we are live again, and we will be live until they decide they don't want us to be live anymore. But every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern, we will be live on the air. So look for some maybe segments that involve the audience, hopefully in-studio audience, and maybe some phone calls down the line.
Yeah, hopefully we can ruffle up a little bit bigger and better studio audience than the one we got right here.
Yeah, they're our two biggest fans. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks from Afrizin, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today we'll cover some of Guy's trips since he returned from Europe, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happened in Baltimore since Guy's been gone. And we're going to start our show off with our guest, and today our guest is with Mary Piper. And Dr. Piper is a clinical psychologist and author of 9 books, including Reviving Ophelia, which was number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 weeks. Her area of interest is how American culture influences the mental health of its people. She lives in Lincoln, Nebraska with her husband Jim, and her passions are her family, being outdoors, birds, books, and protecting her state's environment. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Dr. Mary Piper.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show, Michael.
It's interesting. I was reading an article that you wrote a few months ago in the op-ed news titled Psychological Moment We Are In. And it caught my attention because we had a guest earlier a few months ago, and his name was Reverend Michael Dowd, and you guys, both of you, had some connections that I saw, and I wanted to have you on and get your points of view on dealing with the psychology of living in a culture that's kind of gone, in a sense, mad. And so he talks about things in his, he has a TED Talk called Why We Struggle Now, and in it he discusses our prehistoric brains and how we lived with mismatched instincts and were surrounded by super normal allurements, as he calls it, and how these contribute to many problems we face individually and collectively. Your piece, you state, humans are not built to deal with this level of information flow. We evolve in small communities equipped to deal with proximal stimulation. And it seems that you're connecting dots that a lot of people aren't, and you and Michael as well. And I was wondering if you could explain and talk to our audience about how people deal with, or how people can deal with, living in today's culture and its influences.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't know him, but he sounds interesting. I'll have to look him up after this call. In terms of the different kinds of systems we're using to deal with the world today, The way I put it is we have Paleolithic arousal systems, mammalian arousal systems, Neolithic brains, which is the brains of people who lived in caves and functioned in small nomadic cultures, medieval institutions, and 21st century technology. And it's just a weird mix to deal with. To speak to one aspect of it, the stimulation. Almost all of our history, which is at least by now 2 million years of what we're calling hominids, for almost all of that 2 million year history, what the human brain has been expected to deal with is what it can see, smell, hear, touch, and taste. And that's really called proximal stimulation. I mean, what it means is what is in your immediate proximity. And that's what we were built to deal with. Now, all of a sudden, we're dealing with constantly distal information. Information, for example, this week about what's happening in Baltimore, given I live in Nebraska, that's distal information to me. What's happening with Syria, what's happening in Iraq, and so on and so on. And so we're not really wired for that, and we aren't emotionally equipped for it. And intellectually, we are and we aren't equipped. We can find that information fascinating if it's presented to us in an interesting way, but we can't actually integrate it very well into our sense of who we are and what we do on a basis of our daily lives. So, for example, one thing I talk about in my book, The Green Boat, which is about climate change and why we're so psychologically unable to deal with it, is the fact that, from my point of view, the only really interesting information to me at this point is what I call actionable intelligence, or information that allows me to know what to do next. In other words, if I read about, say, the kidnapped children by Boko Haram, that's terrible news to me, and it's upsetting to me, and I feel very badly about it, and I wish I could do something about it. But in fact, there's almost nothing I can do about Boko Haram. There's just virtually nothing I can do about that. I know nothing about the area. I don't have any connections to anyone in the area. Even people who know much more than me can't figure out what to do about it. And so from my point of view, that is not actionable intelligence. On the other hand, one of the reasons I got involved in finding the Trans-Canada pipeline in my state is I actually know what to do about that. I knew to get together a group of people and start educating fellow citizens and dealing with our legislature and so on. So the information about that was something I could act on. And if we get information we can act on, we can feel hope and we can organize our thinking and emotions and behavior accordingly. However, if we get this distant information that has no implications for action, what it tends to do to us is just upset us. And so we either experience a kind of a state of agitation or we numb ourselves to that agitation. And we just kind of feel a little dull and scattered. So that's part of what I was talking about in this psychological moment.
Okay.
I have a question for you. This is Guy. A relatively recent paper indicates that the genus Homo has been here for 2.8 million years. So
yes. It
pushed back by quite a bit our knowledge of how long our genus, at least, has been around.
Yeah.
You talk about actionable items and actionable hope in there in Nebraska, taking on the Trans-Canadian Pipeline. Do you... Have you seen much progress in your efforts there? Is there a political fight as well as a social battle that must be won amongst the people you interact with? It seems to me that this is a huge issue, and yet most humans I'm familiar with aren't even familiar with the issue, much less are willing to go out of their way between getting their car washed and their grocery shopping done to get involved. Can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we've had great success. We have stopped the Trans-Canada pipeline, not only from coming to our state, but possibly from coming to our country. And if we stop it from coming to our country, we may stop the tar sands development in Alberta and do a great deal to eventually avert, you know, global climate change. Global climate change is happening, so I don't want to pretend the tar sands are the ultimate or the primary culprit. But we will have done a lot if the tar sands are never developed in Canada. And we stopped it in our state with Republicans and Democrats working together, not by talking about climate change, which is a very hard sell in this state. This is a Republican state, very conservative state. Our governor doesn't believe in human-made climate change, for example. We stopped it by talking about water. Everybody believes in drinking water. And one of the things we've learned when dealing with environmental issues is don't talk about climate change. Talk about water and food and health and soil and animals, things that people actually can experience for themselves. You know, the other thing about climate change that makes it very difficult to talk about with people is it's so overwhelming that people tend to almost immediately shut down. And there was a very good psychologist, Stanley Cohen, who wrote about a similar phenomena in Nazi Germany. Because, of course, the Germans during World War II were aware of the concentration camps. But they never talked about them. And after the war, people said things like, well, I sort of knew they were there, but I really didn't know exactly what was happening. Well, that's the way most of us are with climate change. And he calls it a state of willful ignorance. And what he means by that the reality is impossible to ignore, but too dreadful to acknowledge. And so we all sort of hang suspended between not wanting to talk about it, not wanting to be bummed out or bum anyone else out, and on the other hand, being aware it's a terrible thing happening to us. So it's very interesting how people don't deal with climate change. Like, for example, one way they don't deal with it is there's all sorts of places where it doesn't feel right to talk about it. And that's at a party. That's at a family dinner. That's perhaps in a class, a school. It's certainly in a church in many cases. But the effect of never having the right time or the place where it's appropriate to talk about a subject makes that subject taboo. And for the most part, our cultural attitude toward climate change has been, don't act, don't tell. And I don't know about you, but whenever I bring up climate change, I just get the saddest, gloomiest looks. And people just really, really don't want to talk about it. And I feel like I'm inflicting pain on people. So that's almost never how I approach any of the environmental issues I care about. What I say when I run into people, and I want them to be engaged and involved with saving our planet, is here's a project I'm working on now. Would you like to get involved? And here's some of the things we need. And then it's amazing. People step forward because you've actually given them actionable intelligence, and they can say, well, yeah, sure, I'd be willing to do that. Or, well, I can't do that, but what else could I do? And so it's really important how people are approached. It's important that there be some kind of action with any kind of despairing information. That pairing of information that's upsetting and troubling with an action is a really critical part of having people become engaged in saving, I don't even say the environment, I say their environment. Because my firm belief is if we could have everybody working hard to do what they can do in their area, we can save the planet. There's people all over the world who want to work hard to save the planet. And we could actually save the planet that way. Now, we had a lot of political pushback in this state from our legislators and our governor and attorney general and so on. For one thing, the fossil fuel companies have enormous amount of money. And if you want to know how this system works, this political system, try and change it, especially when it involves a fossil fuel company. And you find out that there's an enormous amount of resistance that comes from money and cronyism and so on. But we managed to break through all that by, first of all, being clever and quick and outsmarting politicians sometimes. But the other thing is, we had such a good cause that people all over this state really felt strongly that we needed to protect our water. And one of the things that surprised myself and my progressive urban friends that started organizing around this issue 5 years ago is our first allies were ranchers from western Nebraska out in the Sand Hills. And they might not agree with us on any other issue, but they agree with us in the idea we've got to keep water in the state clean. So there's a lot of ways to have alliances between groups of people that would certainly not align around fighting man-made climate change.
Right. How can people, I guess, on a personal level, get to that place where they, you know, they even maybe show up to hear somebody speak, or they read an article that they may not normally read? In other words, you know, the story they tell themselves about themselves, their self-talk, is there a way we can change our own narrative a little bit and not be so resistant to things that are not necessarily tangible to us?
Well, you know, I think everybody knows this information, whether they're accepting it or not. I think it's that state of willful ignorance, where it's there. We all have it. We carry it in us now. We all carry within us a great deal of fear and gloom about what the future holds. I haven't met anybody who doesn't. So the issue isn't how do we get people to be aware of their own fear and gloom around these very serious issues, or even acknowledge it. Most people at some level will go, yeah, I think it sounds pretty bad, you know, and I'm really worried about the future. I don't know anybody who isn't worried about the future. The trick is that next step, and that next step is going, well, what are we going to do about it? And what are we going to do about it is really the step that's important. And one way, like when I'm working with groups, one place I start is I say to whoever I'm working with, well, what are you already doing? And one of the things that's actually kind of heartening to people is if they start talking, they realize they are doing things, that perhaps they're not using water bottles anymore, or they're recycling, or they're composting, or they're biking to work, or they're trying to consume less. For example, my daughter and her friends are busy. They're not particularly engaged as activists. They're all working with young children. But one thing they've done that is directly tied to their desire to fight global warming is they get together periodically for book exchanges where they all bring the books they've read and trade them around, and clothing exchanges where they all bring their clothes and trade them around. So they aren't going to stores. They're going to exchanges and trading things with other people to save resources for the planet. So one of the other things, Michael, that we found really important is people are much more likely to go to events if they're fun. I mean, we never actually give lectures. We have parties, and we have celebrations, and we have picnics, and we have, you know, all kinds of bike-a-thons, and we have music. We have a lot of music benefits. A lot of the young musicians in our town are in bands that want to be visible anyway, and they're really willing to play a benefit for a local environmental cause. And they get their friends to come. It's not hard to talk a bar owner into letting a band play there for free and us advertise for a crowd and so on. So we always try to have things where people aren't going to a dreary lecture on climate change, but they're coming to an event where they can have a lot of fun and see their friends and still do something good for a cause. Because these causes are our commitments. They're going to be commitments we all take on for the rest of our lives. Everybody's busy. Everybody's pretty overwhelmed and tired in America today. And unless there's something in it for us, unless it's fun, unless we feel like it's pleasurable to stay engaged, we won't stay engaged. It's just too hard in our modern world to stay engaged with things that are depressing and dispiriting. So, for example, our meetings that we have for our group that meets once a month, they're always potlucks. And we have good food and we have wine and we laugh a lot and we have a good time. And nobody sits around discussing, woe is me. Every meeting, we begin by talking about what's happened in the last month, sharing information, all kinds of information about what we've learned in the last month that might be useful to our further work, talking about new projects we're interested in exploring. For example, right now we're looking into encouraging bankers and universities and people in our community, churches, from divesting in fossil fuels. So we have a report on that. But we end our meetings. We always end our meetings with an action where we all agree between now and next month, here's what we're going to do. So there's always a sense of momentum, but between people walking in the door and going home after a good potluck dinner with wine, there's a lot of fun, too. And we're supporting each other. We're sticking together. We're really having a darn good time of it. That's why we've been able to stay together for 5 years and work on these things, is we've really grown to care about each other and have a lot of fun together.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like what you've done is you've built community.
Absolutely, sure, yeah.
I don't know if you know a lot about our show or guys' work in general, but Guy just came back from Europe, and he can talk about that in a little bit. And he does a speaking tour, and we talk a great deal on this show about really an acceptance phase of getting to the point where we've accepted that this culture, in particular, humanity might not make it out of this. And we found that it doesn't necessarily shut people down not to, you know, sit around and do nothing, but in some cases it really frees people up to do almost anything that they would have never considered, and I'm a prime example of that. I've come to a place where I really don't think we have a problem. I think we're in a predicament, but that hasn't stopped me from doing things that you've talked about in some of the questions that you've answered.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible for people to come to a place where they can, their acceptance of maybe their own extinction can be an antidote for despair?
Their acceptance of their own what?
Extinction? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Did you hear what I asked or not?
No, I'm sorry, Michael, repeat it if you can.
I said, can acceptance of what, our own extinction be an antidote for despair?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, not in my own experience. I think, first of all, almost everybody who's really in and dedicated to working on the environmental movement right now has accepted that the fate of the planet is very at risk, you know. There's no question about that. And in my book, The Green Boat, I write about what environmentalists call the oh shit moment.
Right.
When you realize, whoa, you know, we are really up against something terrible. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody in our group thinks that we can stop global climate change. In fact, I'm not sure anybody does. That's irrelevant. We're in this group because all of us want to be engaged in a process that gives us hope. And I actually, in The Green Boat, don't make an argument that small groups of people working together for environmental change can save the Earth. I make an argument that we save ourselves, that social action is an antidote to despair. I make a mental health argument for being engaged, because the alternative is a kind of a despondent, learned helplessness. So I think several of the people in our group would say we're doomed.
Yeah.
But they're still working hard. They're working hard because they're the kind of people that would never, under any circumstances, just lie down and surrender. And that's really how I am, too. We aren't going to surrender to fate. If we all work hard enough, it might just work out that we can pull off saving a livable planet for the future. But regardless of whether we can or can't, which nobody knows the answer to that.
Right.
We have no idea what time it is. We really don't know what time it is. The Earth as we know it could be almost over, or we could be at the beginning of a new and glorious era that allows our planet to live for thousands of years. But the most likely way that new and glorious era will come is if every one of us can somehow decide, I'm going to live and act as if there is hope. And sure enough, one of the amazing effects of acting as if there is hope is feeling more hopeful. I remember the first time I had this group over here, And we sat down and we talked about the pipeline coming in and how we needed to organize some education forums and find some experts to talk to us and such. And we'd have another meeting the next week and invite more people and so on and so on. After everybody left, I was doing up dishes. I'd made that first potluck dinner. And I was humming. I was humming to myself. And I caught myself humming, and I thought, well, my goodness, when is the last time I hummed? And I realized it's because I felt good. I felt hopeful, just because I had actually gone out and done something.
I mean, and I think that's great. I guess what I was trying to, maybe the few people that I talked to this about, because it is a very small circle of friends and acquaintances I have, but I have absolutely no hope.
Okay.
And I am as happy as can be. And I think it's because what I mentioned earlier is once I came to that place of acceptance that there's really no way out of this and it's not really a problem we're dealing with, we're dealing with a predicament, that doesn't mean I'm not doing things and I'm not out there actively trying to, you know, change the world to make it a better place. I'm actually doing more of that than I was doing when I had hope. And so I don't know if I'm just, if I'm an oddball or...
I have
no idea if you're an oddball, and I have no idea if the experience you report for yourself is widely shared by other people. I mean, I certainly know, as I said, in our group there's people like you, Michael, that have no hope, but they're working very hard. And, for example, one thing I do know about you is you have this show. And my guess is this show gives you hope, that it's doing something you can do very well increase consciousness and educate people about issues that you consider very important. And that's probably, my guess as a therapist, one of the key components for your good mental health right now.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, is you talk about interconnection.
Right.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because that's something I guess I'm trying to do a little more of, So explore myself a little more. Maybe you could talk a little bit about interconnection as a survival mechanism?
Right. Well, interconnection can be discussed as a spiritual belief. For example, Thich Nhat Hanh says we inter-are and talks about inter-being. It can also be seen as a scientific fact. I mean, Jeremy Rifkin writes very well about the fact that the whole biosphere is one living organism, and we are all functional bits of the biosphere as one living organism, and that those of us who are fighting to save our planet are that organism's antibodies. The other thing, though, is Gregory Bateson pointed out that interconnection is a survival strategy. In other words, we are alive because we are part of our environment. An organism and its environment comprise a living system. Without the environment, an organism isn't a living system. So it's very important to think about ourselves connected to everything that keeps us alive, whether it's air, water, food supplies, animals. I mean, one of the things that I've really tried to talk about a lot is animals are every bit as essential to a biosphere as humans. And in that sense, humans are not a privileged species. We really need to think about this planet works because everything on it plays a role. And when we start removing the pieces of this planet that do a certain kind of work, eventually we don't have a system that's workable. Now, in terms of interconnection as a felt experience, which is one of my antidotes to despair, my only antidote to despair is not work. Bliss is also an antidote to despair. And one of my ways of connecting and feeling bliss is to just go lie down. I can go lie down under the night sky. I can go lie down on the grass on a spring afternoon and look at the sky. But at least for me, just physically lying down and looking at the sky is a way to feel connected to the whole universe. And it's a wonderful healing experience. But for me, any time that I actually go outside and just walk around and smell and touch and look at stuff is an experience of interconnection. It's a very grounding, happiness-producing experience.
You're listening to Nature Bath Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're interviewing best-selling author and public speaker, Dr. Mary Piper. Mary, this is Guy again. The contemporary rate of extinction, according to United Nations report, about 5 years old, is 150 to 200 species a day. In addition, the referee journal literature going back several years now indicates that civilization itself is a heat engine. So it seems to me that industrial civilization is responsible for the sixth great extinction, one that is proceeding faster than the previous one, and also is a heat engine. It's civilization itself that is heating up the planet. So have you talked about those topics in your group? If so, what's your take, and how do you approach the idea of civilization being the source of our predicaments?
Well, I mean, there's no question that capitalism is a primary cause of the issues we have right now. That if we didn't have a world organized around money, if we had a world organized around sustainability, around quality of life issues, we'd have a very different world. For example, one phrase that's interesting is quality of life. When the capitalist system talks about quality of life, and by talks, it's obviously a system can't talk, but when I'm thinking about the newspapers and our reporting and the way we describe our system to ourselves, we put in brackets under quality of life virtually everything that's important. Happiness, relaxation, time with family, times with friends, times to be with old people when they die, times to be with small children, and so on. Play, leisure, everything like that. Health is quality of life, for example. That's all called quality of life. Well, when you think about it, that's crazy. Why don't we just call that life? But instead, capitalist system privileges capitalism over all other kinds of information in our system. And that's a really, really unfortunate thing. The only reason I don't talk more about, say, abolishing capitalism or rage against capitalism is I personally don't have a clue how to do that. I mean, if I knew what to do and could abolish capitalism and replace it with a wonderful, fair, workable system that created world peace and sustainability, I'd do it tomorrow. I have no investment in capitalism. But I actually don't know how to do that. And I don't think anybody else does either. We have some good ideas and some good paradigms, and I hope we can develop over time a way of evolving into a different kind of system. But that's nothing I have any knowledge or expertise in. So I try to stick with that which I actually can parse in a way that allows me to understand what to do next. I don't tend to waste any of my time worrying about things I can't deal with as a problem for me to solve. And so, ending capitalism, for example, that's just not in my wheelhouse of skills. I want to say one other thing, though, about power, and that is power exists because we believe we are powerless. If we think we are powerless, it's all over because we won't act. On the other hand, if we act as if we have power, we create power for ourselves overnight. When our little group started to fight the Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline, we had absolutely no thought we could succeed. There were four of us in my living room trying to even understand what the tar sands were and what we were dealing with. We were urban liberals. We never win an issue in our state. We're the royalty of lost causes. I mean, it was ridiculous that we would sit in a room and think, well, let's stop the Trans-Canada pipeline. We didn't think we'd stop it. We just thought we'd fight it because we didn't like it, and we wanted somebody in our state to register a protest. But the really interesting thing that happened is we started acting like we could stop it. And more people believed we could stop it. And then they decided they could stop it. And before we knew it, we stopped it. And that is one of the really critical things, is that you have to believe that if you act as if you have power, you can create power. Now, that's something we learned. We didn't actually believe it. We learned it. But you have to, one way or another, realize that power is something you can create out of thin air by your own actions. And if you think you are powerless, it's all over. One of the interesting things about the climate change discussion, especially from the far right and the fossil fuel companies, is for a long time the discussion was climate change doesn't exist. Now, oftentimes the discussion you hear is we can't do anything about it. Interestingly, both of those ends of the discussion skip over the critical middle part that says, actually, human beings may have some agency here, and we may be able to actually do something about it. If we act as if we have power, if we believe we can do it, we might actually be able to do something. So it's just a really interesting thing. To say you are powerless is, in one way, to abdicate your responsibility. Well, what can I do? I'm powerless. But it's also, in another way, to increase your own depression, because we now know that one of the critical effects of a belief in one's own powerlessness is despondency and despair.
So it's really about making, I mean, this entire conversation is really about making these connections. And I think it seems to me you started it with your Reviving Ophelia book, and now you've moved to your latest book, which is The Green Boat. And is that kind of what the book is the basis of, is making these connections and being active and having hope based on, you know, your progress and so on and so forth?
Well, I'm actually by nature a pretty optimistic person, and my background is in psychology and anthropology. And being a therapist all of my life, I actually have to believe in my bones that people can change. Why be a therapist if you don't believe people can change?
Good point.
It's a really critical part of being a therapist. You can't sit for 8 hours a day in a small office talking to people about their pain without some belief that between the two of you, you can figure out a way to help them feel better and live happier, more fully realized lives. But what really interests me is how culture affects mental health. So, of course, I'm very interested in climate change. I got very interested in why, with the extraordinarily terrible information that we had at our fingertips, nobody was doing anything. And that led me back to my old familiar niche, which is the intersection of culture, in this case a savage capitalistic culture leading us toward planetary doom, when culture meets individual personality. And that's where I worked with the Green Boat, is given that collision between the basic optimistic human, and most of us, I think, are by nature optimistic until we're educated away from that. When that terrible cultural collision occurs, how is it we can pick ourselves up and respond in a resilient manner that not only helps us move forward with hope, but helps other people in the planet as well? So that's a really interesting question to me that was worthy of a book.
So what's next for you then?
Well, I'm actually starting to write a book on getting old. So that's kind of what I'm interested in right now. Every life stage I go through, I decide to write a book about it, because I really find that my way of coping with anxiety is getting information and thinking it through and synthesizing it for myself. And then as I figure out something, I love to explore things that I'm deeply curious about. And then as I figure out something, I find that I'm really interested in helping other people see what I figured out.
Well, very good. Well, we appreciate your patience for coming on the show. I know we had to postpone on you last month, but we appreciate you sticking with us and coming on.
Thank you. It was a real enjoyable conversation. Best wishes to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
You've been listening to Dr. Mary Piper. She's a clinical psychologist, author of 9 books, including Reviving Ophelia, which was number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 weeks. And her latest book is The Green Boat. Okay. So we have Guy back in the studio after being gone a month on a touring. tour of Europe. He looks a little better than he did yesterday when he returned to the mud hut. He was a little numb, kind of zombie-like. But today he went to coffee, and I think it kind of woke him up a little. So I know you talked about some of this last week, and you talked about it on other programs, but maybe a summary of what happened.
Sure. It was wild.
I mean, all right, that was great. Thanks.
It was just really, really intense, going all the time. A little story from my departure. It really is a microcosm of the whole trip. I'm 40 minutes drive from Heathrow Airport. I'm leaving out of London. I'm staying in the home of a videographer, Nick Breeze, who's done some great interviews with climate scientists, including a pretty famous one with Natalia Shikova. And he and his partner were kind enough to let me stay overnight. And then I'm a 40-minute taxi ride away from the airport, so I leave 3 hours before my flight.
That's a man.
What could possibly go wrong?
Everything.
As it turns out, you're right. How did you see that coming?
Wow. I know your life.
So we get within a mile and a half of the airport. It's all going smoothly. And there's a tunnel a half a mile in front of us. Just 1 mile from the airport, there's a tunnel. And the tunnel is blocked. And we don't know why. And so the taxi cab driver is calling dispatch and on the radio and trying to figure out what's going on up there. And we sit there in traffic, waiting, waiting, and just getting more and more nervous. Finally, an hour passes. I'm sitting there in the cab for an hour. And in Europe, you have to be at the gate half hour before the flight picks off. And, you know, had to clear security, an international flight. I was supposed to be there quite a while ago by now. And so finally I said, all right, can't do this anymore. Thanks for the ride. I paid him. I started walking. I was going to walk through the tunnel. It's only a mile and a half. So I got on my new hat, courtesy of one of my hosts, Robert Leisure.
Very good.
Makes me stand out a little bit, though. I'm slumping my luggage behind me. And I get to the tunnel and the dam breaks, and suddenly everybody's going 50 miles an hour through the tunnel, everybody except me, because I'm on foot and the authorities are there. You can't go through the tunnel, sir. There's too much traffic. Oh, damn.
I don't understand your British accent.
That's inconvenient timing. So I go back. I'm looking for my taxi guy. He's disappeared.
Right.
So I'm standing there at the entry to the tunnel and in the middle of five lanes of traffic, holding my arms up, trying to get people to stop. Let me tell you. The crazy guy with the hat and the luggage standing in the middle of five lanes, nobody's going to stop for him.
Look at the mustache on that guy.
So of course nobody stopped. Jeez, they just went sailing through. You know, finally they had to stop because there was traffic up ahead. There's a light. They had to stop.
Yeah.
So I would talk through somebody's window. I'd say, can you give me a ride to the airport? And two or three of them said, no, we're not going to the airport. I'm like, this is five lanes. It only goes to the airport. But they're not going to the airport with me. That's what
right.
I meant. Oh, man. Finally, I got some poor South African woman to agree to give me a ride to the airport. And I was running as fast as I could to get from spot to spot. I made it 3 minutes before the gate closed. And so here it is. It's 8:30 in the morning. I'm sweating my ass off. The adrenaline is just surging like crazy. It's the same way I started every day and ended every day. It was perfect, really. Can't believe I made it back.
So how many events-ish?
25 or so in 22, 23 days. And a lot of travel between events, staying in a different bed almost every night.
Right.
And so spending a lot of time on buses and trains and missing the train connection from one place to another. Yeah. So it was without question the most intense speaking tour I've ever done. And half the time I didn't even know where I was.
Yeah.
You know, I read on Facebook several times. It's on Facebook, so it must be true. I read on Facebook several times that I'm over there having a vacation.
Well,
Jesus, I was delirious. I didn't even know where I was. I was exhausted the whole time. I'd be looking out. I'd wake up from a train ride just long enough to take a picture. I'd post it on Facebook. Oh, look at you. You're having a great vacation. Right. Except for the delirium.
Right. Well, it's the life of a rock star.
Yeah, I know, except rock stars sometimes take a day off, I've heard. I know, I've heard stories. And they have groupies.
They hey,
Oh, wait. Yeah.
We have a studio audience.
Yeah, we have...
Of two.
We have group. Well, that's by definition. That's
right.
Not a onesie. It's a groupie.
I'm a stalker.
A stalker, whatever.
So, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that was... It was just so busy, and people thought I was some sort of star in that when you watch television shows, nobody ever goes to the bathroom, and nobody ever eats, and nobody ever takes a shower. So there's no time built into the schedule for any of that. And so by the time I get back to the States after 3.5 weeks, I really had to go. And I really had to shower, too.
Excellent. Note to self, Catherine. So how about highs and lows as far as audience reception? And
one of the highlights came in Iceland, where there were only a dozen people at the first event. It was sort of exclusive, and
so half of Iceland was there.
Yes, almost exactly. In fact, my host there said there's almost exactly 1,000 times as many people in the United States as there are in Iceland.
Right.
With half of the 300,000 people in Iceland living in Reykjavik, in the capital.
You really pulled in.
And he said, so if I affect one person here, it's really 1,000 people.
Right.
That's the ratio we're using. So a dozen people came to that first event because a dozen people were invited.
Or 12,000.
And then about 12,000 people showed up. It was quite a deal. And then I had lunch with three of the people afterward, and they didn't really appreciate what I was saying at all.
No.
And they thought I was wrong about everything, of course. Like, I've never heard that before.
And they're scientists, right?
Well, they're... No.
They're experts, then? they write about this for a living?
No.
Oh.
They're guys on the street.
They read something on the Internet.
Yeah.
Well, there you
probably
go.
Probably on Facebook.
Right.
So it must be true.
So they had something to offer.
Anyway, the best part about it was two of the three then came to my talk the next night.
Right.
And they
made sure you were wrong.
Right. And at that talk, there were 25 or 30 people, so it was much. And so they were hearing this for the second time, and one of them comes up to me afterwards, and he said, I'm sorry about how I acted at lunch. I didn't really know what I was talking about.
Yeah.
It's just this strong emotional reaction I had. And now that I've heard you for a second time, I get it. I mean, you're right. You're just presenting the evidence that is put out there by others.
Right.
So, yeah, I can't disagree with anything you said, actually, now that I thought about
it. Wow. That's a quick turnaround. That has to be a record.
And that's 1,000 people, remember?
Right, right.
I just influenced 1,000 Americans or the equivalent thereof.
Right.
Just like that. So that was kind of cool. That was actually fun.
And Iceland is, for the record, they do something.
They do.
So there might be something done.
They send bankers on the run.
Right.
Yes, I've never seen a more, how do I say this politely, bleak country in my life. That wasn't the right word, was
right. It? Probably not. Oh, the mail's coming.
I mean, I flew in and I took a bunch of pictures going in because it was beautiful.
Right.
It's fire and ice.
Yeah.
What that means is there's a bunch of black lava and white ice. It's a black and white country. It's perfect for my chromatic rich challenged eyes. But, oh, wow. It is cold.
Yeah.
They don't call it Iceland for nothing. And the wind blows.
Yeah.
The wind blows blowing the whole time. Really hard. And I ask about 20 people, or three-quarters of the people in Iceland,
right.
Is it always like this? And they said, no. Sometimes the wind really blows.
Oh.
And it was just howling all one night. I thought the house was going to blow over. And there's actually an architectural style called...
Dramatic pause.
I forgot the name of it.
Yeah, you told me yesterday.
Brutalism.
Brutalism, yeah.
Brutalism. And that's
brutal there.
Yeah. That's what they specialize in, these sort of concrete block buildings that were popular in the United States in the early 1970s.
Right.
That looked like we were afraid of the Russians or something. Oh, wait.
Right.
We were. It's called brutalism. The whole country was brutal.
Yeah.
And people lived there. Yeah. And apparently are quite happy about
it.
And I have to say, I was never happier in Iceland than when I was sitting in the warm geothermal pond.
Oh, man, there you go.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
If I lived there, I'd never get out.
Right.
And they had this one place that it actually had a bar and food, so you never had to get out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I did. it's all geothermal. The whole city of Reykjavik and almost the whole country, almost everybody in the country, has geothermal water that comes through the tap.
Yeah.
That's cool. Spectacular.
If that didn't exist, nobody would be there.
Oh, exactly. They're only there for the hot showers.
Right.
Which are guaranteed, as long as there's volcanic activity there.
Yeah.
So that was big fun. The best attended event had about 140 people,
okay,
and two volunteer simultaneous translators,
oh,
which was awesome. It was really nice of them.
What languages are we talking in?
They were translating in French. And interestingly, on this trip, I went to 8 countries, and France was not one of them.
Yeah.
But there's a part of Switzerland where they speak French.
It's the international language. I think at the Olympics, they always, you know, French. And
right. French and American.
American, right.
So there's simultaneous French translation from a couple of really nice people who just volunteered their time. Had they been charging for it, it would have been thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
They were really good. I had another event that was not simultaneous translation. It was translation, and they have a different name for it.
Okay.
And it was brutal.
Yeah.
To use that word again. I would speak for 10 seconds or so, and then she would translate for 10 seconds or so. And according to the people in the audience, notice I tell all of whom spoke English. According to a bunch of people in the audience, she was putting a much more positive spin on my message than I was putting on it. But I couldn't hear that because she was speaking in German.
Right.
And I barely speak English.
What's the German phrase, he doesn't mean this? It's a joke.
So the 40-minute presentation lasted an hour and a half, and it was really difficult to get through for everybody concerned, especially the translator, because she didn't want to speak any of this.
Right. So how are you breaking, I mean, for those people who have not maybe seen the presentation, but, well, I mean, how do you break the ice to these folks to get, you know, you're going to talk about some pretty heavy stuff. So.
Well, right. So one of the things I did throughout this trip, well, first of all, I had exquisite people traveling with me, including Ariadne Luya, who was my personal assistant for this trip. And so she went to every presentation for 2 weeks, and she took notes on every one.
Okay.
And so I got instantaneous feedback.
Right.
So from the first presentation, I was modifying every subsequent one.
Okay.
But on every presentation, I started by showing a little commercial from Xbox.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's called Life is Short. And in 50 seconds, this person shoots out of the womb through the window of the hospital and then goes through space. And then he curls up when he's in his 80s or 90s and his teeth are all falling out. He curls up and boom, he smashes into a coffin.
Right.
And so I start with that. And then it ends with Life is Short. Play more. Xbox.
Right. And then any questions? Question and answer, you're done.
Right. And so that's how I would start.
Yeah.
I'd say, so that's my whole story right there. Are there any questions? This is going to be my shortest presentation ever. And then nobody would ask any questions. They'd just sit there looking stunned.
Right.
Maybe that wasn't a good way to start. And so then I would start with the IPCC and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their conclusion in their fifth assessment that global warming was irreversible.
Right.
This is among the most conservative scientific bodies on the planet.
Yeah.
And they say that global warming is irreversible in the absence of massive geoengineering of the atmospheric chemistry, what Truthout called fantasy technology.
Yeah.
And that notion has been supported by several people, several referee journal articles since then,
yeah,
half a dozen, that it's not going to work. So that's a nice way to start. It really gets their attention. And then I show more video clips throughout the presentation, most notably that four-minute one from the newsroom.
Right, the climate. EPA guy.
Yeah, the EPA guy. And it's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, it's 4 minutes long. And when it's done, I point out that clip only addresses carbon dioxide.
Right.
Like all the major assessments, it ignores methane and the other handful of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And they talk about things like mass migrations and food and water shortages and spread of deadly disease. All those things are already underway.
Right.
So I point out that, you know, this is not the kind of thing that's going to happen in the future, as they say in that episode. They're happening now. All of those things are happening now. And I give a bunch of examples. In Europe, notably, they are being swamped with people from the Middle East and Northern Africa.
Right, they just said that ferry sink again. Another boat, I should say.
So they know about mass migration.
Right.
And they know that they're underway,
right
there in their backyard. And then New Zealand, of course, recently opened their doors to people from island states, small island states in the South Pacific that are losing habitat for humans because of climate change. Up until last year, it cost $2 million to get into New Zealand.
Right.
And now, if you come from one of those small island states, the door is open.
So you're saying I can move to this island, say a week.
Right. We're talking about vacation, just have a little layover.
Is there some sort of loophole here? Right. Interesting.
I'm pretty sure Americans aren't really welcome.
Right, right.
We're from the larger island.
Turtle Island is.
Yeah.
Until we renamed it.
Right. America.
Right. So, would you do it again?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm motivated by something internal that drives me to do these speaking tours, right. But this one was really grueling,
yeah.
And so I think I would take better care to leave time to take care of myself,
right.
Along the way,
yeah.
Because when you're going from one town to the next town to the next town, the person who hosted me in each town,
yeah.
Just had me for 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so it's all a party for them.
Yeah.
You know, they get to interact with me for 24 hours, and they get to stay up late. They don't realize I've been doing that for 2.5 weeks. And they're going to get up early because, you know, so what if they only get 4 hours of sleep that night? They got the next week to catch up. Fortunately, I have the next month to catch up.
Yeah. Well, you live the microcosm of how most people live their lives. They just stop and smell anything. And they
That's right.
Go, go, go.
On the treadmill.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of how it felt.
Right on. Well, good to have you back.
It's good to be back. I have a renewed sense of rejuvenation hanging out with my neighbors doing a coffee today. Looking forward to the potluck and, of course, interacting with you and Karen here at the Mud Hut.
Well, folks, we have a new time slot, and just to remind you, we are on at 3 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, so you can catch us in the afternoon. We will try and make it a little more interactive because we are live, and we haven't been live in about 6 months, so we're excited about that. So that wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like us on Facebook, Nature Bats Blast on the Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Blast on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to ask us, and maybe we can take some calls eventually. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions and our guest, Mary Piper, and to Atherton for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very, very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Gonna get you.